Chapter 8. Films and television were crucial to my development as a kid and stand accused for causing me to choose the occupation I have devoted myself to for almost 40 years. At around the age of 10, I would go to the movies every Saturday with a friend and see whatever was showing in a nearby movie theater that our parents had deemed appropriate for our innocent eyes. I remember sitting through a Planet of the Apes marathon one Saturday and emerging from the theater bleary-eyed, exhausted, and, because I'd spent so long in an altered reality, very confused as to why there were no simians on the streets of Mount Kisco. Although I did enjoy reading, especially anything to do with the Second World War, I also spent so much time watching old movies on our black-and-white Zenith television that my parents had to pry me away from it over and over and over again. On certain afternoons, there was The Million Dollar Movie on Channel 9. This was usually some classic drama to which I would glue myself as I ate an excessive number of buttered hard rolls or peanut butter sandwiches. I was also addicted to so many of the classic television shows of the 60s and 70s, like The Rat Patrol, The Brady Bunch, The Wild Wild West, and Lost in Space. The latter three, for better or for worse, would become Hollywood films over 30 years later. I also loved watching cooking shows, and as the years went on, there were more and more of them on WNET, the New York City PBS station. Just as certain actors led me to acting, there are two television cooking show hosts who had a profound impact upon me and are partly to blame for my heightened interest in the subject of food. Watching someone cook on camera is fascinating, and these two people did it better than anyone, in my opinion. The first is, of course, the queen of culinary TV, Julia Child. The second would be her prince, Keith Floyd. I shall begin by addressing the queen, as she always deserves to come first. Julia Child. Julia Child changed not only what Americans cooked and ate, but greatly impacted their diet of weekly television viewing. Her show, The French Chef, which originally aired in 1963, was one of the first cooking shows on American television and lasted for 10 years. Watching her expertly debone a chicken or make a tarte tatin, often making mistakes along the way, made viewers feel that they too could create such dishes themselves. Her achievements in the world of food are staggering, from her first and seminal work, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, to countless others, as well as season upon season of shows hosted either alone or with other great talents like Jacques Pepin about the art and craft of cooking. Much has also been written about her, including Julie and Julia, a wonderful book that was made into a film of the same name in which I was fortunate enough to appear. I don't know that I have much to write on the subject of making the film that would fit into these pages, but I can say it was a great honor to be asked by Meryl Streep and Nora Ephron to play the role of Paul Child. Actually, I do have a tale to tell regarding Julie and Julia, but you're going to have to wait a little bit. It was one of those rare working experiences, not unlike The Devil Wears Prada, that one wishes could be repeated. Obviously, there's probably one reason for this, but I won't give it the credit. Anyway, ever since I was very young, Julia Child has always fascinated me. My mother tuned into The French Chef religiously, and I remember watching with her and loving it. I don't know, however, if it was my mother's keen interest in everything that Julia did or Julia's keen interest in everything that she herself was doing that I found so captivating. However, I do know that watching The French Chef with my mom was a way to spend some time with her because with three kids and a full-time job, she was incredibly busy. In fact, we would often watch the show when she was ironing or folding laundry, as just watching television without doing something productive simultaneously was anathema to her. I personally still struggle to sit and watch a film because I always feel that there are too many tasks I need to accomplish. This strange sense of guilt makes no sense, because as an actor, writer, and director, it is my business to watch as much as possible. Yet for the most part, I only watch something while exercising or at the end of the night when the younger kids are in bed, dinner is complete, and the kitchen is in order. However, at this point, I'm usually so tired it's a bit of a struggle to last very long. Anyway, after that unnecessary information about my psyche, as Julia was working away on a batch of crepes or making a souffle, my mother would comment out loud about her process, aside such as, "Huh, so that's how you do that," or, "Well, I think that's a little too much butter," or, "Isn't she just so great?" were heard as she flicked water from her fingers onto a cotton shirt neatly draped over the ironing board. My mother adored and admired Julia Child, and in turn imparted those feelings to me, along with an avid interest in how someone goes about cooking a meal. To that point, I remember when visiting my parents years later, I happened to catch an old episode of The French Chef. Because my interest in food had grown, I watched it with even more attentiveness than I had when I was young. But on this particular occasion, I was taken aback by my reaction when Mrs. Child bid us her ubiquitous farewell. "This is Julia Child. Bon appétit!" My eyes suddenly welled up, and I had to stop myself from crying. Why was I suddenly experiencing a powerful rush of emotion because a black-and-white moving image of a chef was saying goodbye to me in French? After a few moments, I realized that I was moved by Mrs. Child, not only because she brought back happy boyhood memories of spending time with my mom, but also because Julia herself was so genuinely happy to be doing what she was doing. I saw in that moment the embodiment of what I and so many of us aspire to spend your life doing what you love and doing it well. To achieve this is a rare thing, but for those who can, real joy is theirs, as is the ability to bring that joy to others through their chosen vocation. Although Julia Child struggled in early adulthood to find a profession that suited her intellect, curiosity, and lust for life, as well as one that would make her happy, she more than made up for it over the years, from the time she made her first omelet to the time she wished us all a final breathy bon appétit. She also inspired and made millions of people the world over very happy as well, including a mother and son in Westchester, New York, over 50 years ago. Keith Floyd. American audiences may not be as familiar with Keith Floyd as they are with Julia Child or many of the television food personalities on today's screens. Too many, as far as I'm concerned, but who am I to talk? But for the Brits, and for me as well, Floyd set the gold standard for the television food travelogue. In episode after episode, he conquers the recipes of entire countries as he swills glasses of wine while eruditely displaying an encyclopedic knowledge of their cuisine. If you have never seen his show, it is now easily found on YouTube and is a real treat for any food lover. The format of the show is basic. Floyd travels to a foreign country or a region of England and cooks classic local dishes in kitchens borrowed from farmers, landed gentry, housewives, fishermen, and chefs. He also often cooks en plein air. In one episode of Floyd on Spain, he cooks a pork stew in the Spanish countryside. In an episode of Floyd on Italy, he makes a local pasta dish in the piazza of a small Italian town, and in another, a fish stew aboard a fishing boat in rough waters. When filming in a public place, the handheld camera candidly catches the locals as they look on bewildered, amused, and even annoyed as this mad Brit in a bow tie and suspenders conjures up their traditional dishes with a booze-fueled fervor while prattling away nonstop to the camera. I recently watched an episode that took place in a small home kitchen that he had commandeered in Provence. The sequence begins with a continuous 6-minute take, something you would never see on a cooking show today. Floyd starts out with a sip of wine as he shows us a sink full of fish he has just bought at a local market for a Provençal fish stew he's about to make. He directs the camera operator to get a shot of this and a shot of that as he describes the type of fish, then directs the fellow to follow him. Colander of fish in hand, as he moves over to the stove, explains the base for the stew, dumps the fish in a pot, adds some hot water, then swiftly moves over to the oven, takes out a chicken that is roasting, explains the manner in which he has prepared it, but tells us how the matron of the house told him he had done it improperly, and then says he doesn't really care what she thinks, and he doesn't really know everything about French cooking anyway, as he deftly makes his way back to the stove where, in 4 separate pans, simmer the ingredients of a ratatouille, explains each one individually, then combines them and wraps up the sequence with a sip of wine and a comment about needing a break. He does all this for 6 minutes straight without a pause. If you have ever tried to film yourself or have someone film you, preparing even the simplest recipe while talking to a camera, you will know that it is close to impossible to do it without having to cut and reset countless times. It is most likely that you will make mistakes again and again and will eventually have to edit the bits and pieces together later on. To sustain a take for 6 minutes and keep it interesting and entertaining is a feat I challenge any of today's television chefs to attempt. Is the production quality of Floyd's show the greatest? Hardly. But his energy, excitement, and profound knowledge about what he's doing, along with some impressive handheld camera work, makes for an incredibly dynamic and entertaining cooking show. In one episode, he is hunkered down with the Royal Navy somewhere in Cornwall and cooks Portuguese man-of-war, a dish I had never heard of, that combines pork, onions, tomatoes, and a variety of mollusks, in rectangular pans over a makeshift stove of mud and bricks on a characteristically miserable gray English afternoon while slurping rum from a teacup. The whole sequence, which is composed of only a few shots, happens very quickly and is as wonderfully entertaining as it is bizarre. Do we know how the dish tastes? No, we don't. But does it really matter? Not to me. Floyd made us feel like any one of us could make any of the dishes he made, even with the most rudimentary kitchen kit, the most primitive fire source, in the worst weather, in the middle of fucking nowhere, while swilling just about anything alcoholic from a tin can. Besides being entertaining, whether he was roughing it or cooking in the kitchen of a Michelin-starred restaurant, Floyd was incredibly informative, and you walked away from each show feeling you had actually learned something about the history and culture that were the root of the dishes he prepared with such assurance. He did this without being precious or pedantic, spitting out the information quickly as he chopped, stirred, sautéed, basted, and of course, in his words, slurped. He died at the age of 65 of a heart attack. Too many years of smoking and excessive drinking took their toll on an autodidactic cook who taught real chefs more than a thing or two and gave great pleasure to many food lovers all over the globe. What Keith Floyd did by taking the cooking show out of the studio, into the streets, onto the seas, and up to the mountaintops, changed the face of food television for better and forever. Those of us in that world should take a lesson from his irreverent improvisatory style and follow in his peripatetic footsteps. I remember my acting teacher, George Morrison, telling us that audiences love to watch people eating, drinking, or smoking on stage and screen. This always stuck with me. As usual, he was more than right. Having seen countless films and plays since my college days, I know there is indeed something very compelling about watching someone carry out a very necessary mundane task. It humanizes them and therefore allows us to connect to them. It's probably one of the reasons why people love food movies and why there are so many cooking shows on television now. Also, we want to see the process, either because it's something we love to do ourselves or because it's something we aspire to do. But we also want to see the reaction to the result of the process because we aren't there to taste it ourselves. Was all that effort worth it? Could I do that? Does it taste as good as it looks? Or, perhaps most important, does it really taste as good as they're saying it does? This is a bit of a bugbear of mine. Whether it is an actor, a chef, or a cook, I think you can always tell when someone isn't really tasting something. You don't even have to look that closely to see that this happens too often on the excessive number of cooking shows that inundate today's television. It seems that before whatever is being eaten has touched the tongue of the chef, host, cook, they are rolling their eyes in ecstasy, moaning and shaking their head as if it's the most delicious thing ever to have crossed their lips. To make matters worse, before they have even finished swallowing, the word perfect is sanctimoniously whispered. All I can say is, no, sorry, I don't believe you. There is no possible way that you are actually tasting whatever you ate that quickly and that whatever the hell you made is actually that extraordinary. And who the fuck ever, even brilliant chefs, makes something that is perfect right out of the gate every time? More often than not, there is something not quite right. It's too sweet or not sweet enough or needs more salt or pepper or oil, or there's too much whatever. To see someone adjust seasoning or comment on what has worked or doesn't work in a dish is 1,000 times more interesting and instructive than their giving themselves a clearly false pat on the back for their culinary genius. When someone really tastes something, Whatever process happens in their mouth triggers a reaction in their eyes as well as the rest of their body. First, the body almost freezes as though it were on high alert, and then people will often tilt their head to one side, usually to the left, and look like they are listening very carefully to something as they are chewing. Often their head will nod slowly, their eyes darting back and forth. At times, their eyes will lock, staring straight ahead for a moment, and then they'll glance down to the left and then to the right. After all this, which can happen in an instant or take quite some time, they will utter a sound of approval or disappointment, such as, mmm, if they like it, or, mmm, if they don't. They will then say something like, good, I like it, or, I should have ordered the steak. Watch Julia Child taste something, and you'll see what I mean. Inspired by these two multi-talented pioneers, I recently embarked on a project in which I tried to put their teachings to good use, searching for Italy. If you haven't seen it, I of course take umbrage, but will rise above your insult, ignore your ignorance, and give you a quick synopsis. The show is a documentary series filmed on and off during 2019 and 2020. Each episode focuses on the food of one Italian region and the forces that help shape it, in order to show the extraordinary diversity of the country's cuisine. Because of where Italy sits geographically, it has been invaded and controlled by countless cultures over the past 2,000 years. Those cultures have influenced the cuisine as significantly as the widely varied topography of the peninsula, which stretches from the Alps to the southern Mediterranean. For instance, Punta Pesce Spada, which means Swordfish Point, on the island of Lampedusa, is only 96 miles from the coast of North Africa. In Val d'Aosta, one of Italy's regions on the Swiss border, is its most northern point, Westliches Zwillingskopfel, which in German means, Jesus Christ, is it cold here, or is it just me? It actually doesn't mean that, but you take my point. During the shoot, I encountered some extraordinarily talented people, from chefs to home cooks to farmers and purveyors, not to mention an endless supply of delicious dishes. I would like to include them all here, but this book would end up as a 6-volume set. Besides, I don't have time to write it because I have to go out and make a living, so you'll just have to tune in to the show. Please check your local listings for viewing times. However, I have chosen 3 different dishes, one from the north, one from the middle of the country, and one from the far south. I've done so because I believe they represent the wonderful diversity of the Italian table. Their only commonality is that they are all made with some type of pasta. Pizzoccheri, Le Alpi. One of the most beautiful regions in Italy, in my opinion, is Lombardy, situated in the very north of the country and home to Milan, Lake Como, and the Arabic Alps. Like other northern regions, its food varies primarily from that of the south due to topography and climate. In these mountains, where the land sees quite a bit of rain and snow, tomatoes and eggplant are not as prevalent as root vegetables and cabbage. Grain grown for pasta throughout the southern parts of Italy gives way to corn, both yellow and white, used to make polenta, rice for risotto, and buckwheat. It is with the latter that one of my favorite dishes ever is made, the traditional Lombard recipe known as pizzoccheri. Pizzoccheri is a noodle composed of approximately 50% buckwheat flour and 50% wheat flour, about the length and width of pappardelle, but a bit thicker and more dense. It is served during the autumn and winter months in a kind of casserole called pappardelle alla Valtellina. Valtellina. The name sounds like that of an imagined zaftic wood sprite from a Fellini film. Good God, what a gorgeous chunk of Alpine cheese is Valtellina. Its soft, gentle creaminess, when melted, just wraps itself around. Off to take a cold shower. I'm back. Anyway, pizzoccheri, like most Italian food, comes from humble beginnings and has a rightful place in the canon of cucina povera. Using very few ingredients, it creates an extremely rich and hearty dish. After a winter's day outdoors in the Alps, like raclette or venison stew, it is exactly what a body wants and needs. But there is one more key ingredient that elevates this dish, another cheese called bitto. In the tiniest of tiny Italian mountain towns, Gerola Alta, Paolo Ceparelli is carrying on the age-old tradition of making this historic cheese. Beto is made from the milk of cows that graze on the alpine mountain flora. Since the pastures are at different altitudes and receive differing amounts of sun and moisture, the flora vary, and they each impart their particular flavors to the cow's milk. Beto has been made this way for centuries, yet new EU regulations, which are often at odds with traditional methods, have allowed the cheese-making process to omit crucial steps and add new ones, therefore altering its true character and taste. For this reason, with the support of the slow food movement, Paolo has chosen to continue making Beto the old way, calling it Beto Storico, historic Beto, or Beto Ribelle, rebel Beto. Historic Beto is made with the addition of about 10% indigenous aerobic goat's milk. The addition of goat's milk allows the cheese to be aged for an extraordinary amount of time, usually for about 5 to 12 years, but sometimes up to 18 years. This is unheard of in the world of cheesemaking. The depth of flavor this amount of aging imparts is the reason it is the most expensive cheese in the world, selling for over $6,000 for a 20-kilo wheel. Visiting Paolo's Casera, cheese cellar, is basically like entering a museum of aroma. The rich, deep, complex smells coming from 1,000 wheels of cheese caused even my nostrils and my eyes to salivate. It was almost overwhelming. As I was about to rip open a wheel with my bare hands and gnaw my way through it, I noticed that Paolo had laid out 3 cheeses of various ages for me to taste, along with some local wines, hence saving me from an embarrassingly feral public episode. The differences between them were distinct, the oldest cheese being the most dry and most potent, the youngest slightly softer, and the cheese aged for a certain amount of time between the two tasted, unsurprisingly, like a bit of both. This is the same experience one might have when tasting Parmigiano in varying stages of age. However, each morsel of the triad of Beto had an extraordinary complexity and depth of flavor that I had never tasted in a cheese before. I cannot explain it other than to say it was exactly the sum of its parts, and then some. Mountains, rain, snow, cows, goats, grass, and time. Although I know that Parmigiano is known as the king of cheeses, on a blustery day in a cellar in Gerola Alta in the aerobic Alps, according to this palate, that milky throne was usurped by tiny fragments of 3 ancient wheels of Beto. After visiting Paolo that day in his subterranean lactic lair, I went to a small stone cottage farther up in the mountains where I had promised to make pizzoccheri for the crew using a hunk of Beto gifted by Paolo. As we made our way up to the cottage, I began to panic. What the fuck was I thinking? I had only made the dish a couple of times before, and it had never quite turned out the way I had hoped. I had eaten it for the first time at Riva, a London restaurant run by Andrea Riva, who hails from Lombardy, where it is made to perfection, hence my obsession. As my panic was peaking, we arrived at this gorgeous but tiny stone cottage that had been in the same family for generations. Once a barn for animals, it had been renovated into a charming weekend retreat. We were greeted by the owners, 3 generations of them, the grandfather in his 80s, his daughter, and her teenage children. Suddenly, I realized I was not only making pizzoccheri for the crew, who had no idea what it was supposed to taste like and were always starving, so I could easily get away with a mediocre version, but I was to prepare it for the family as well, all of whom were Lombards and knew this dish better than anyone in the world, especially the octogenarian patriarch. I took a deep breath, poured an enormous glass of cold white wine, and basically acted. Yes, dear reader, as you have seen me do for close to 40 years now on stages and screens big and small, I simply pretended that I had been making pizzoccheri since birth. I moved with swift assurance as I talked through the steps while the cameras rolled, and within about 40 minutes from the initial pasta-making process to the final grate of Beto, I served up the best pizzoccheri I have ever made and probably will ever make. Even the grandfather devoured his and told me it was perfect. He was to die that night. Kidding. How did I do it? Why did it work? When fear grips the soul, it's amazing what one can achieve, especially when the cameras are rolling. Now, I am sure that the indigenous ingredients, local buckwheat flour, sweet white alpine butter, voluptuous Valtellina cheese, and of course the Beto, had a great deal to do with the successful outcome. I would also not be afraid to suggest that the comforting ambience of a stone cottage heated by an old wood stove as a mix of rain and snow blanketed the foothills of the Italian Alps perhaps played a significant role as well. As they say, location, location, Vito, acting. Here is how pizzoccheri is made and what you must do in order to truly understand why the dish was created ages ago. First, make sure it's cold out. Then, go for a hike up a mountain or partake in some winter activity such as skiing, skating, wood chopping, alpine cow milking, hunting, ice fishing, axe throwing, or, perhaps, cheese making. Pizzoccheri. Serves 4 to 6. 1 medium Savoy cabbage. A big, sexy slab of Valtellina cheese, or something similar, like Fontina. 3 large yellow potatoes. A fuck of a lot of butter. 4 large garlic cloves. 1 pound pizzoccheri. Extra virgin olive oil. 2 handfuls grated Parmigiano Reggiano, or Vito, if available and you can afford it. Salt. Remove and discard any tough outer leaves from the cabbage and roughly chop it into long pieces. Thinly cut about 15 pieces of Valtellina cheese and also grate about 3 cups. Set aside. Preheat the oven to 325 degrees Fahrenheit. Peel and dice the potatoes and boil until cooked but still firm, about 15 minutes or so. Halfway through boiling, add the cabbage to the potatoes. When the potatoes and the cabbage are cooked, drain them and set them aside. In a large deep frying pan over low heat, melt the fuckload of butter. Gently crush, if that's even possible, the garlic cloves, place them in the pan, and cook until they soften and the butter is melted, but not turned brown. Boil the pizzoccheri until al dente and drain, reserving about 2 cups of the water. Return the pizzoccheri to the pot and drizzle them with a little olive oil or some butter so they don't stick together. Pour a little of the garlic butter into a baking dish and begin to layer the ingredients, starting with the pizzoccheri, then the cabbage, then the potatoes, then both cheeses, drizzling more garlic butter over the whole mixture after each layer, adding a bit of the reserved pasta water to ensure it doesn't get too thick, but making sure it doesn't get too watery. You may need only a cup. Top the final layer with a drizzle of olive oil and more grated cheese. Cover with foil and bake for about 15 minutes or so. Remove the foil and return to the oven until the top has a slight crisp. Salt to taste. Serve it and eat it and drink a lot of wine with it and think about how much you deserve it after you've burned off so many calories being so active in the frigid out of doors. Carbonara. Roma. Spaghetti alla carbonara. Fuck. It's incredible. Especially at this one place in Rome. Fuck! Allow me to better articulate. Unlike pizzoccheri, carbonara is universally known and loved by pasta devotees, but there are so many iterations of it that I am compelled to set the record as straight as a record can be set straight in the complex and personal world of Italian cooking regarding what makes a true carbonara. No one really knows the genesis of this rich and unctuous dish, but supposedly the basis of this typical Roman fare was invented by shepherds in the hills of Lazio who brought pasta, guanciale, and Parmigiano or Pecorino Romano with them when they went to tend their flocks. The combination of those ingredients would become known as pasta alla Gricia, and it is the addition of eggs that creates alla carbonara. It has also been posited that carbonara was actually a post-World War II invention of the Romans to satisfy the palates of the American and British soldiers who pined for their breakfasts of ham and eggs. I must admit this rings dubiously to these ears, as well as to those of Aldo, the owner of the Roman restaurant Pomidoro, which serves what is to many, including me, the best carbonara in a city of carbonaras. Aldo was 8 years of age when his family home and restaurant in Rome were bombed by the Americans in an attempt to flush out the German troops as the Allies worked their way northward into the city. With the exception of him and his father, his entire family was killed in the blast. Fortunately, after the war, the neighbors helped them rebuild both their home and the restaurant. Aldo is now in his 80s, and he and his restaurant are still very active and consistently turning out what is probably indeed the best spaghetti alla carbonara that I have ever tasted, hence my profane outburst earlier. As with most recipes, it is the quality of the ingredients that makes this dish greater than the sum of its parts. Guanciale, cured pork cheek, from local breeders, eggs from naturally raised chickens, traditionally made and aged pecorino or parmigiano, and high-quality dried pasta, Aldo recommends Cavaliere Giuseppe Cocco spaghetti, which can be easily found online, are the only ingredients necessary to create a meal that somehow manages to be as elegant as it is rustic. I have a recipe for carbonara in the cookbook that Felicity and I wrote together years ago, The Tucci Table. And even though it is tasty, like many recipes, it is something of a bastardization of the dish. In a true carbonara, only guanciale is used, and never pancetta. There is no onion or garlic, and certainly never, ever, any cream or butter. People often think that the latter two ingredients are necessary in order to give the dish its proper creaminess, when in fact, this effect is achieved by not only the combination of egg yolks, cheese, and pasta water, but the timing of when they are incorporated. Aldo's daughter made this classic dish so effortlessly for me the day we filmed. To watch her do so was revelatory. Gorgeous, fatty, peppery strips of guanciale are sautéed in a deep saucepan. Once they have rendered, al dente spaghetti is placed into the pan with them. The heat is turned off as a mixture of whole eggs and egg yolks is poured in. Everything is then gently tossed together with handfuls of parmigiano and some of the starchy pasta water. When I tasted it, I could not help but hug Aldo. The flavor had such depth that it practically penetrated my soul. It was like I'd met a wonderfully kind, long-lost sibling I never knew existed and with whom I could now spend time for the rest of my life. Okay, maybe my reactions are a bit extreme, but I dare you to go to Pomidoro, eat the carbonara, and not just shout something like, "Fuck!" One can even make carbonara within a hollowed-out wheel of parmigiano. After combining the guanciale, egg, and pasta, place the mixture into the hollowed-out wheel and toss gently with a large fork and spoon, scraping the cheese from the bottom and sides of the wheel as you do so. The hot pasta will melt the cheese, making this action very easy, and create a silken viscosity that makes for a great bit of culinary theater, besides being a cheese lover's wet dream. Spaghetti alla Bottarga, Sicilia. Whenever I'm traveling for work, especially to places with which I don't feel an affinity, finding any affinity with anything is crucial. It will not surprise you to know that I attempt to find an affinity with the food. I usually seek out small restaurants that are well practiced in preparing classic dishes. Obviously, I am always drawn to an Italian menu, but I may find a French, Japanese, or Chinese place that serves up well-prepared old standards. After long days of filming in odd locations and too many weeks alone in hotels, a good restaurant with consistently well-cooked classic fare is as close to home as one can get. One of my go-to comfort dishes is a rather odd one, and not often easily found, spaghetti alla Bottarga. Bottarga is dried fish roe, usually from red mullet or bluefin tuna. It's used in abundance in southern Italy and Sardinia, where those fish are plentiful, and grated onto pasta or sometimes sliced thinly and served on bread. It is pungent and salty with just the right amount of fishiness to lift a bowl of spaghetti to new places, not unlike truffles do to anything they encounter. Like all things salty, Bottarga is quite addictive. Whenever I have splurged, it's not cheap, and procured a chunk, I find myself not only making pasta alla Bottarga, but grating it on any and everything. I've rained it upon eggs, shrimp risotto, and spaghetti alle vongole, and all are delicious. In Sardinian restaurants, its presence is practically inescapable. If there's a precious block of it in front of me, I struggle to stop myself from slicing it paper thin, popping that wafer of concentrated roe in my mouth, and just letting it melt. Of course, you can only eat so many of these briny biscuits before you become completely dehydrated. Whenever I end up in Los Angeles, always against my will, I often head directly from the airport to Medeo, a wonderful Italian restaurant on Beverly Boulevard, and order spaghetti alla Bottarga because they make it so well. I don't know why I find it so comforting. Yes, the salt is appealing, but maybe it's the utter simplicity of the dish that attracts me. While revising this chapter, I discovered that Medeo has closed. I don't know the reason why, but I'm sure, like so many customers, I'm heartbroken. When we filmed our episode about Sicily, we had the good fortune to interview a self-taught chef named Tony Lococo. Tony, who has the solid build of a rugby player and a handsome bald head that deserves to be sculpted one day, lives with his family on the outskirts of Palermo in the town of Bagheria. It is there, in his tiny, elegant, Michelin-starred restaurant, I Pupi, that he has been transforming classic Sicilian dishes into modern marvels for quite some time now, and one of his specialties is spaghetti alla Bottarga. Tony and his wife are warm, open-hearted people with whom I felt instantly at home. Although he spoke no English and had to suffer through my Italian, we hit it off instantly. On the day of filming, we started rolling our cameras in the kitchen, where Tony showed me how he makes his version of my favorite saline bowl of carbs. Afterward, I also ate a number of his other dishes, including a flight of Sicilian sashimi, 7 varieties of fish, each paired with a different homemade flavored oil and salt. My fingers can't find the words to describe it. To begin, this creative and physical powerhouse of a man makes his own pasta dough. He then puts it through a machine with a perforated bronze plate at the end, and the dough emerges in strands of thick spaghetti. The bronze gives the pasta a rough surface, allowing the sauce to cling to it more easily. I'm buying one tomorrow. A little olive oil and a little garum are drizzled into a hot pan. Garum is a fermented fish sauce that has been made for millennia in varying forms by many cultures to impart umami flavor to a variety of dishes. The version Tony uses is made with anchovies and is known as coloratura di alici. The cooked spaghetti is then placed into the pan and tossed with the oil, the garum, and a little bit of the pasta water and plated. Lemon zest is grated on top, followed by a shower of grated Bottarga. Pre-fried dehydrated capers, amazing, are then added along with mollica, a mixture of breadcrumbs and dried ground anchovies. When it was done, Tony and I shared the bowl of it right there at the stove. Good God, simple, so simple, yet sensorially stunning. And for me, very comforting. Were I to ever end up making a film for an extended period of time in Bagheria, fingers crossed, Tony Lococo would find me at his door every night of the week, seeking comfort through his nourishment.